This is Jim Inkster. Happy 4th of July to you. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Philip Manuel, the fantastic singer from New Orleans, performing tonight as the city of New Orleans gears up for the Essence Music Festival. The festival has been around since 1995 that has taken a life of its own. It's also the 75th birthday of the great singer Bill Withers, one of Philip Manuel's favorites. Jennifer Moses, an author who has written about Baton Rouge more than once and about Louisiana, recently in the New York Times, she wrote a feature about the legendary painter Clementine Hunter. Jennifer Moses is also the author of Visiting Hours, a novel based in Baton Rouge. We will talk with her. And Michael Gurian, his book is The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number. Outside our area, it is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Today is the 237th birthday of the United States. It's the 75th birthday of the great singer Bill Withers, and one of the men who sings Bill's songs like nobody else is Philip Manuel, the fantastic vocalist from New Orleans, who's with us. Tonight he'll be at Snug Harbor, 8 p.m., 10 p.m., 626 Frenchman Street. Good morning, Philip Manuel.
How are you, sir?
Doing well. And as I said, nobody does Bill Withers like Philip Manuel.
Well, you know, Jim, Bill Withers was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame a couple of years ago. And as a lyricist and a writer, I know why, and I want to thank you, because I'd like to sing one short verse to one of his songs that really sums up why he's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. I hope your audience doesn't mind. Can I do that?
Certainly. Go for it.
Okay, the song is called, well, I'll just do it. Grandma's hands clapped in church on Sunday morning. Grandma's hands played the tambourine so well. Grandma's hands used to issue out a warning. She'd say, Billy, don't you run so fast. Might fall on a piece of glass. Might be snakes there in that grass. Grandma's hands. And it don't get no better than that. That's right up there with Stevie, with the Beatles, you know, with Cole Porter. I mean, those are just fantastic lyrics.
And he wrote that song, too.
And, this is his stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's about his life. And in that song, he tells the life of his community. I mean, talks about an unwed mother, you know, through his grandmother's hands, you know, how she soothes the unwed mother. So, yeah, happy birthday, Bill.
And I'm looking at his career, and his first hit was Ain't No Sunshine, which went to number 3 on the U.S. charts, and then it was followed by Grandma's Hands,
yep.
Number 42, got to number 42, Lean On Me was next, number 1, and Use Me, number 2. So,
and Lean On Me, I don't know a person alive who doesn't know that song.
That's a great song, isn't it? You hear it in churches.
You hear it everywhere.
Yeah,
it has many lives.
It does. Well, as I stated, you're performing tonight, but this is quite a weekend in New Orleans, the Essence Music Festival.
Yes.
It's was started 18 years ago as a one-time event to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Essence Magazine. And now it is the largest event celebrating African-American culture and music in the United States.
That's pretty darn good.
It is indeed.
Yes. And I can't argue with that.
Snug Harbor should be rocking tonight.
We're going to have a real good time. And, Jim, I don't know whether I can talk about this, but I'm doing a new record. The record is called Coincidence. And I've started this. I found out, my son told me about this, Kickstarter.com. So I've opened this Kickstarter account where people from all over the world can you know, contribute to your record. So I just wanted to let people know that, and, I hope that's okay.
That's all right, Kickstarter.com. the voice of Philip Manuel. If you can hear it on the telephone, it's vibrant as it is in person. He's described as smooth, soothing, sophisticated, and soulful. And you do Bill Withers, Nat King Cole, Lou Rawls, you name the vocalist, this man can do it. Quite a versatile singer. Who's your favorite?
My father probably is my favorite singer of all time, followed by Ella, Donny Hathaway, Andy Williams, a classical singer named UC Jeweling. I have a few.
Andy Williams. Now, there's a guy who was a tenor. Do you do any of his music?
I do some standards that he used to do, but Andy Williams, I mean, when my father always appreciated singers, regardless of what the genre, what the race, what it didn't matter. And I learned that same appreciation. And Andy Williams cannot be denied as one of the smoothest, most even, just expressively wonderful sounding voices ever. I mean, it's just a beautiful instrument, period.
He had great stage presence, too.
He was just a great, great singer, great host, and that's why, that's why he did what he did for so long.
The Philip Manuel Quartet, 8 p.m., 10 p.m. tonight at Snug Harbor on Frenchman in New Orleans. And, Kevin, let's give a listen to Philip, one of his fine works.
Looking back on when I was a little nappy-headed boy, then my only worry was for Christmas what would be my toy. Even though we sometimes would not get a thing, we were happy with joy the day would bring.
The great Philip Manuel.
Jim, thank you, man, for thinking of me. I appreciate it.
Well, you can do it like few other people. This is the birthday of our country. There's a story in the New York Times today, and the headline reads, "Oh, Say Can You Sing at the Ballpark." It's a tough song. Have you ever done the national anthem?
I did it. I've done it a couple of times. Probably the biggest one was at the opening of the fairgrounds in New Orleans one year. I'm not really afraid of that song. I like singing that song. It doesn't bother me at all.
You got to have some pipes to do it, though, to do it well.
And you just got to remember the words. You just forget that you sometimes forget the words to that song. You know, people have that issue with it. But I love it.
Yeah, Robert Goulet forgot the words before the Muhammad Ali, Sonny Liston second fight in Lewiston, Maine.
Oh, many of them have.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's not a song that everybody can embrace well. And today,
not for the faint of heart.
You are correct, Philip Manuel. But you do all kinds of vocalists, and you do some of your own work as well. How often do you write songs, Philip?
I write so much for a living in my other life, you know, as a professional writer in public relations and marketing person. I haven't been writing as many songs of late, but I think that's the way it is with musicians. They go through periods where they write a lot, and then they go through just ebb and flow, just like the rest of life is, I think, Jim.
How often do you perform?
I perform a few times a month, generally. Private stuff a lot. I'll do Snug sometimes, and I've done Cafe Istanbul, as you know, a couple of times recently. So I try and stay out there and stay active, and it's great to see all the youngsters coming up, man, who are, like, playing at Essence this weekend, you know, like Shamar Allen and Mia Borders and folks like that. So, you know, we all have our niche. We all find our space.
Well, New Orleans is a city that embraces music like no other. At what point in your life did you know this is what you wanted to do?
Oh, it was never a decision I had to make, Jim.
It was in the genes.
You know, Yeah, sometimes you just, I don't know whether it's a blessing or a curse, but I knew pretty much from the moment I could talk and, you know, and I started singing almost then. So I always knew.
You always knew.
I always knew. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should write that song.
Gerald says he'll come see you tonight if you do some Bill Withers.
Absolutely. Tell him he can count on it.
8 and 10 at Snug Harbor. Kevin, let's give a listen to Bill Withers on his 75th birthday, and Philip might even do this song.
When I wake up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eyes, and something without warning, love, bears heavy on my mind, then I look. And I know it's gonna be a lovely day.
You've done that one a time or two, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. I do this one quite regularly, as a matter of fact.
No, Bill Withers was married to Denise Nicholas from Room 222.
Yep. Who, you know, I always think when I hear the song, I don't know whether you know the one where he says, "Who is he and what is he to you?"
Yeah.
I always wonder if that was for her.
Yeah, they had some difficulty down the line, and maybe that was about her. And, you know, when he was dating her, I remember seeing Rosie Grier on The Tonight Show, and he was upset because he was interested in Miss Nicholas. And
oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. And he took up. He even took up.
You know, man, you can't be a great songwriter without some grist in your life, without some warts and some angst. You know, I mean, I'm convinced of that.
I think I think, Philip, the same is true of comedians. You have to have felt some pain in your life to be funny.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I certainly do agree. I think in all art, whatever it is, there's a certain sense of that.
Well, as
we're getting pretty philosophical here, Jim.
We are, and you got to get up for two shows tonight. But as we let you go on the 4th of July, you've lived in New Orleans for, I guess, your whole life. And
my entire life. I've lived away for a few years, but here and there, but New Orleans has always been home, and I'm here to stay now.
Despite the warts, the obvious challenges in New Orleans, why is it a city that not only people who are natives like you are enthralled with, but people who've never been there, the first time they come to New Orleans, it's like, wow, I've never seen any place like this?
I think it speaks to the essence. I'm glad you asked that question. I think it speaks to the essence and the soul of the people here. There's a culture here that you won't feel many places in the world. And I think that's what it is. Many writers have tried to put their finger on it. I just think that that's what it is. I think it's just the essence and the soul of this city, you know?
And there's no place where you have so much musical energy.
No, New Orleans is really alive musically now. And since Katrina, it's been that way. And it was always, you know, it always had its music scene. But since Katrina, the music scene is, you know, it's off the chain. And that's a good thing.
Well, tonight, Philip Manuel will be part of it in a big weekend for New Orleans and for Louisiana. The Essence Music Festival is taking place, and Philip Manuel is performing at Snug Harbor tonight, 8 and 10 p.m. Thank you so much, Philip. Always a pleasure.
Jim, thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Talk to you soon.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye.
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 297-5633, your number. We'll be back on this 4th of July presentation of our show with author and painter Jennifer Moses. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. We're joined by Jennifer Ann Moses, a prolific writer, also a painter, and we're going to talk about some of her work that includes Baton Rouge as the backdrop. She lived in this community for 13 years. And recently, as in a few weeks ago, she was in the Sunday New York Times for a feature about the legendary painter Clementine Hunter. Good morning, Jennifer.
Happy birthday, Uncle Sam.
There you go. Well, you're fascinated, as many are, with this lady, a painter from Natchitoches, who never left Louisiana. What is it about her work that is so enduring?
Well, it's beautiful. For one thing, her color, her palette is extraordinary, and it's very joyful. It's obviously her work is extremely childlike, but it's not childish because it's so intelligent, it's so humorous, it's so suffused with life as she understood it, and I just think it it captivates the eye. Certainly captivates my eye.
Well, yeah, and it's like no other. Although there have been some artists who have tried to emulate her, and some who have forged her work, but you have captured it in all its essence. There was a great feature, including some of the fine work from Clementine Hunter in the New York Times of June 16th. When did you first become exposed to it?
The funny thing is, as you mentioned, I lived in Baton Rouge for 13 years, and we moved to New Jersey 5 years ago, almost exactly to the day, with my daughter in the back seat crying for however many miles it was. But I started painting myself when I lived in Baton Rouge. I wasn't a painter. I was only writing then and raising my children. And if you'll forgive me, this is a little bit of a long story, but I was a volunteer for years at St. Anthony's Home in Baton Rouge, which is a home for people suffering from AIDS, and it's run by Our Lady of the Lake. And every now and again, everybody would go out and to the main room, the sort of living room area, and sing gospel music. And I loved the music, but I couldn't join in. And it's not because I'm Jewish. I am Jewish. It's because I can't sing. And so some of the staff there decided to pray over me so that Jesus would grant me a voice. And I was like, I'm okay. I'm Jewish, but I'm down with God, you know, with any name. And so they prayed over me, and they prayed over me, and I'd go home, and I'd sing in the shower, and my voice still was terrible. And then one day I just picked up a paintbrush, and it burst open with me. And so I painted and painted. I couldn't stop painting. It was very childlike. It was very folk arty. And my friends started coming over and saying, this is like Clementine Hunter. And I was like, who's Clementine Hunter? I'd heard of her, but I wasn't real interested. And I was then afraid to even look at her work because I didn't want my own inner vision to be influenced by somebody else, a great master. I wanted to be true to my own vision. But bit by bit, I began to see her work and just, you know, I was just slain by it. I just completely fell in love with her work. And the irony is, so I was in Baton Rouge for 13 years. I did all kinds of reporting from Baton Rouge during the years I lived there, both travel pieces, you know, just about the swamps, about New Orleans. I once did a piece on Baton Rouge itself. And I did a lot of post-Katrina reporting, too. At that time, it was mainly for the Washington Post. And that was a great privilege. But it took 5 years after I moved away from Louisiana to be able to write about Clementine Hunter. So it was a great privilege for me to get in my little rental car and tootle on up to the Cane River Valley, you know, and I happened to be there in April when it was the best weather, I think, you know, it was much better weather than I experienced in 13 years in Baton Rouge. It was sunny, it was warm, there was no humidity. Do you remember that, Nate? It was late March, actually. Do you remember that? It was so weird.
it,
I was like, if this is the new Baton Rouge, I'm moving back.
It always seems like it's humid here. But
it's pretty humid.
But occasionally humid. We get a break every now and then.
I'm aware, yeah. But I don't think, I mean, it was cold at night. It was so weird.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, weather aside. So anyway, that was my opportunity to write about Clementine Hunter and her work. You know, it's just beautiful. As I researched her life a little bit, the book I relied on most was the one by Shelby Gillie, who has the Gillie's Gallery in Baton Rouge on the corner of Airline Highway and Florida Boulevard. He died some years ago. His son is now running the gallery, but he wrote, I think, mm-hmm. one of the sort of standard text on her and on Clementine's work. But one thing I read in that book is that she considered her gift really a gift from God. She painted for joy. She didn't paint for money or for fame. And I find that very profoundly moving.
297-5633, if you'd like to join the conversation on Independence Day with Jennifer Ann Moses. Last time she was with us, we were talking about Bagels and Grits, A Jew on the Bayou. Her most recent novel, Visiting Hours, based in Baton Rouge. It's about people, AIDS patients, and those who care for them. I'm sure that your experience that you just discussed had a big impact on Visiting Hours.
Oh, sure, of course it did. I'm a bit of a chameleon, I think, because I tend, or maybe a sponge would be a better metaphor. I really do tend to soak up the rhythms and the colors and sort of the feel of any place I live. I mean, I'm like East Coast Yankee, born and bred, going back the generations. But maybe it was because I lived in Baton Rouge such a long time, and we really raised our three children there. So we had a very, you know, those are the really big, fat, thick years when you're raising your kids, you know. But I soaked something up in the atmosphere in Baton Rouge that's unique to Baton Rouge, and I poured all that into Visiting Hours. And Visiting Hours, what you just described, it's a novel set primarily among AIDS patients and those who care for them in Baton Rouge. It sounds like so depressing, but in fact, it's quite funny and hopeful, or at least that's what some of my reviews have said. But I have to say, the best review I got for it was from my next door neighbor. I live in the Garden District on Terrace Avenue, so my wonderful next-door neighbor, Liz Spaulding, read it last fall, and she wrote to me, and she said, "For a yuppie Yankee, you sure do get us right." And that, to me, was the highest, you know, that was the best compliment I could have gotten.
Why did you move back to the East Coast?
Well, my husband had taught, it was at the law school. He was a professor at LSU at the law school there for 13 years. That's why we moved down to begin with. Because he was offered the job there, and as he puts it, LSU traded him to Rutgers. Rutgers Law School's in Newark, New Jersey.
Right.
And we live in basically the suburbs of New Jersey, about 6 miles from Newark, and we're 11 miles as the crow flies from Times Square in New York. So it's not so bad.
No.
Not so much crawfish etouffee, which we didn't eat anyway because we keep the Jewish dietary laws. But, you know, there's better and worser things about every place you live, and we'll always miss Baton Rouge. I mean, I left a piece of my heart in Baton Rouge when we moved, but we love it here also.
Misty in Denham Springs. Good morning, Misty. You're on the air with Jennifer Moses.
Hi, Jennifer Moses.
Hi, Misty.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you, like, man, I almost could kind of cry. You, just listening to you and your story, I'm not for sure about this painter that you're talking about. I don't even know who she is. But I think that the fact that you recognized her for that and then embraced that within your own self and that you're able to share that is awesome.
Oh, thank you. Aren't you sweet? Thanks. Well, that's, you know, it took me a long time to get where I am now in terms of appreciation of the bounty of life. And I grew up very, very East Coast, kind of focused on kind of resume success. I had to unlearn that, and living in Louisiana helped me with that, because Louisiana, I hate to speak in such broad cliches and generalizations, but in general, Louisiana is a more heart-centered place. People relate to each other more from the place of the heart, and in general, and again, I'm speaking in very broad strokes, the East Coast is more kind of cerebrally centered, and it's for better and for worse. It's not like one is better than the other. It's a mix. But for me, living in Louisiana, where you know, there's a sort of premium on the human connection, was a lesson I badly needed to learn, because the way I'd been raised, it was more about your career, really. So when I met, you know, when I got to when I discovered the work of Clementine Hunter, and she was so much about the love of the work, and she considered her own immense gift, a gift from God. I mean, she, as far as I can tell from reading about her, she had pride in her work and certainly great joy in it, but she didn't really have ego about it. She wasn't like, oh, I'm a great painter. She was, this mm-hmm. is a gift from God, and I'm going to put it out in the world. And to me, that's liberation. You know, that's inner liberation.
Right. She didn't start painting until she was in her 50s.
Yeah, she was raised right after, you know, in Jim Crow. She was raised on a plantation where African Americans did backbreaking labor for almost no money, you know. I mean, it was the Jim Crow South. She was not even allowed to her own first exhibitions because they were in segregated. One of her earliest exhibitions was at Natchitoches, you know, at Northwestern State. She wasn't allowed to her own exhibition because it was segregated. And it's just astonishing. But yeah, she was a field hand. She picked cotton. She was illiterate, and she was a very, very skilled seamstress also, and so she was brought into the big house to serve, and I don't think she cooked. I know she served. Mm-hmm. I don't know what all the tasks were that she had in the big house when she came in off the fields,
but she started sewing,
and that was the period during which she picked up a paintbrush. She was already middle-aged, into middle-aged.
But she lived to be 100 years old, didn't she?
101, yeah, nobody knows exactly. 100, 101.
And there is a opera about her, is that right?
Right. There's an opera called, and I wrote about it, it's a Robert Wilson opera that premiered at Montclair State University. I live in Montclair, so I went to, you know, Montclair State University is about 2 miles from my house. I saw the opera. It's very, very moving, but it got me thinking about Clementine Hunter again. Yeah, it's called Zinnias, The Life of Clementine Hunter, I believe that's what it's called, but it's a Robert Wilson opera.
Well, as I stated, we talked when you wrote Bagels and Grits, A Jew on the Bayou. You're somewhat amused by the juxtaposition of life in New Jersey and the Garden State and life in the Bayou State.
Well, yeah, it's different, you know. I mean, that's what makes America great. What can I tell you? You know, I live about 3 miles from where the Sopranos house was in the movie, you know, in the HBO series. it's New Jersey. Where I live, it's very Italian. It's very African American. It's African American. It's a much bigger ethnic mix. I'm in the greater New York City area. So it's about as ethnically mixed as any place on the planet. It's it's Italian, it's Irish Catholic, it's white Protestant, it's African American, it's Jewish, it's Polish. It's a mix. It's New York City. You know, it's the greatest support for immigrants in the United States. So this is a, you know, this is a different kettle of fish. It's a different mix of accents. It's a different mix of religions. It's a different mix of skin colors than Baton Rouge. And again, it's not better or worse. It's different. And I enjoy, you know, I'm American. I love the mix. I love the mix. I wouldn't want to live in. Well, we lived in Scotland for a year, 10 years ago. It was my husband's sabbatical from LSU, and he kind of got a gig at the University of Glasgow, and we lived in Glasgow, Scotland for a year. And, you know, people there, it's not that there's no mix at all, but the Scots are Scots. You know, they're white, they're pale, they have blue eyes. They're wonderful. I love them. And there is some, in Scotland at least, some population of people coming in from the former British Empire. So there are many, particularly in people, Pakistanis and Indians. Mm-hmm. But you don't have a mix in Britain, for example, that you have in the United States. You just don't. And I'm just completely rambling. But that's where we are. We're okay. A melting pot.
Yeah. What do you think of your governor in New Jersey?
You know, I'm a Democrat, okay? I was a loudmouth Democrat even in Louisiana, where it didn't make me a whole lot of friends. I'm a Democrat. You know, Chris Christie has a kind of appealing, in my opinion, brash personality. And I loved what he did after Sandy hit, where he wouldn't play politics. That was brave, and he may have sunk his own future political career. But he's done a lot of stuff in this state that I really have a hard problem, you know, really think was incredibly stupid. For one thing, he killed the new tunnel. We desperately need greater public transportation in the tri-state area, and he killed the tunnel that former governors and senators had worked on to raise the money from Washington so we could have a new tunnel under the Hudson River. I mean, you think traffic on I-10 at rush hour is bad, baby? You got to come to New Jersey to see traffic. It's not good, and we need more public transportation anyway because we have a little problem with global warming. So he killed that, and after that I was like, you know, I don't like you anymore.
Think he can become president?
I have no clue. I think it's a long shot. I think the Republicans are the Republican Party right now is in such turmoil. They've so shot themselves in the feet over and over again that I think it's going to be hard for them to get organized next time around. But, you know, what do I know?
Well,
I'm just a voter. Just one voter.
You're a delightful personality. We hope we talk again soon, and glad you have remembered your years in Baton Rouge fondly, Jennifer.
I'll never forget my years in Baton Rouge. I love Baton Rouge.
And it's the backdrop for her most recent novel, Visiting Hours, and another great read is Bagels and Grits, A Jew on the Bayou. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Happy
have a good
July.
Happy 4th to you. And we'll be back with Michael Gurian. His book is The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633, your number, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is Michael Gurian, a renowned marriage and family counselor and the New York Times bestselling author of 26 books. He co-founded the Gurian Institute in 1996, speaks at hospitals, schools, community agencies, corporations, and churches, and consults with physicians, criminal justice personnel, and other professionals. And he is with us to talk about his latest work, The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, Dr. Gurian. Good to hear your voice.
Thank you.
So, after 50, what happens?
Well, you know, there's a whole second lifetime, actually. I start the book by talking about how miraculous it is, and we're just catching up to it. Just over 100 years ago, the average lifespan or life expectancy was 49 years old. And now, you know, depending on whether you're male or female, it's late 70s, early 80s. So, you know, we've basically gained a second lifetime here. And that's what this book's about. As I was working with clients and also myself getting older, I were helping people to stage. You know, we were just kind of getting older. We're getting older, and then we become elderly. But I really wanted to see if there were stages. So I looked at brain science. I looked at biochemistry, anthropologically, and blue zones where people are living to 100, looking at the stages they're living. And I was able to develop this three-stage model, so 50 to 65, 65 to 80, 80 onward. And that became the core of the book.
You call the years 50 to 65 the age of transformation. What do you mean?
We, everybody, and this is pretty cross-cultural, everybody goes through an internal process of menopause or andropause, right, depending on your sex. So there is an internal transformative process that nature is putting us through. And the age of transformation is about becoming conscious of it. So so for men and for women, and then just for human beings, to become conscious. Everyone I studied, all our interviews, focus groups, the Gurian Institute focus groups, and all the surveys, they all came back with people reporting a number of things in the transformation. One is they were trying to become elders. They didn't have language for it yet, but they knew they were transforming from just being an adult, you know, to becoming something else. And some of it is also because their kids grow up or they're in a second marriage, you know, and they want to do that differently. So they're transforming that. They're also transforming toward lower stress. By 65, nearly everyone had to decrease their stress. So de-stressing became huge just for survival. And then freedom. People talked a lot about freedom, that we're transforming toward some kind of freedom, and they needed help defining what that was. And often they would say the freedom to be myself. You know, they were trying to finally do that in their 50s and 60s. So those are some core concepts there.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757 for Dr. Michael Gurian. His book is The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50. How did the genders differ after turning 50 years old?
Yeah, I have a chapter, really about a chapter and a half on that, and it's fascinating. Some of the gender differences that people will have noticed previously still exist. Some of them harden, and some of them soften. So I'll give an example of each. A gender difference that people may have always noticed is that women tend to use more words for things that are sensorial, like color, you know, things you smell, things you taste. And that's robust across the world, actually. In general, women have more words for sensorial, and women have more words for emotions, the variety of emotions they're feeling at a given moment. Well, that's a difference that stays pretty solid. However, and one part of it hardens. One part that hardens is that men lose even more memory more quickly than women for sensorial and emotional things. So that hardens. In other words, that difference gets hardened by the time they're 70. They have even less access to that information. But one thing that softens in that area is emotion. Men, as they get older and as they move through andropause and testosterone goes down and the brain shifts and transforms, men open up a lot of emotions they didn't have before. So, for instance, they'll have emotions with grandkids that they couldn't access with their kids. They'll cry more, have more tearing up, and have more immediate, visceral, and beautiful emotional responses. So it's sort of three things happening at once. Some differences stay, some harden, some soften.
Okay. You write that there is healthy intimacy as we age, and there is unhealthy intimacy. What's the distinction?
Well, yeah, that chapter, first half on intimacy, second half on sexuality, and they're both huge. Sexuality is a big deal, and it does shift. And then intimacy shifts toward more separateness, and that's actually very healthy. Couples that try to move through these stages of life and still try to be as sexually, physically, and emotionally intimate as they were when they were 30 or 40, those couples will tend to fail. It's very interesting. And it's the psyche, as the psyche individuates, as we go, we become more individual and free to be who we are, you know, between 50 and 65 and onward, our psyches are actually trying to become somewhat emotionally separate. And so people who have been married 30 years will recognize this. If someone's been married 7 years, they may not. But if they've been married 20 or 30 years, they'll recognize that you create your own lives and that that's how intimacy actually moves into the next phase of life. So, but people who are trying for constant intimacy, like trying to force their spouses, you know, to have sex 3 times a week, if that's not a fit for him or her, those marriages get into a lot of trouble in that sort of, after the kids are grown, the sort of 20 years of marriage. And they don't make the transformation as well because the two separate selves are not allowed to flourish. So intimate separateness is what that's about.
Mm-hmm. What about codependence? Is that an issue?
Well, yes. I mean, it's definitely the basic personality disorders and those areas of issue can continue all through life. In our age now, you know, given that economic freedom is available to everyone through even through divorce or to most people even through divorce, I find that folks who feel very codependent, like codependent with an addict, that they tend to end those marriages because they have the freedom. They feel now, the kids are generally grown, and they feel the need to separate and perhaps separate completely through divorce. So codependence can absolutely be an issue, yes.
Well, you're a marriage counselor of significance, as we know, and I think it's inevitable, as we humans are, that we have conflicts, and especially with those who we love. But if you're 50 years old or past that and you've been married a long time and there have been a few bumps in the road, do things usually get better or do they get worse?
Well, they get better if one develops a healthy intimate separateness. They do. In other words, equal balance of intimacy and separateness. They get better. A lot of these issues get worked out. The kids are grown, and we have the freedom to do this and to concentrate on it. But and at the same time, a big, you know, two things can happen. One is there's just so much built up stuff that as the kids are teenagers or whenever it happens or after they're grown, you know, a divorce happens. And, of course, a divorce could have happened earlier. So not everything gets solved, right? I mean, being 50 doesn't mean that all our hopes are met and our dreams are met. And if we had the dream of staying married forever to that person, it may not happen. So no guarantee. But if we concentrate on balancing intimacy and separateness in a new way, a new transformative way, we have a greater chance of finding the love we always wanted. And it may be already there in our relationship. It may be we form a new relationship. But mm-hmm. at that age group, that's what's needed, balance of intimacy and separateness. And that's the best chance of doing this for another 20, 30 years.
All right. 297-5633, The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50, from New York Times bestselling author Michael Gurian. Melissa asks about older men and younger women and older women and younger men. Sometimes people in their 50s have companions or partners who are significantly younger than they. How does that work?
Yeah, all of that is within the range of normal for human development. And the only way I would get involved ever in you know, even making a comment on it, because really we're free beings and we all have the right to do what brings us joy. The only way I would get involved and comment on it is if it becomes a situation of infidelity, you know, where that invades a marriage. But otherwise, older men, younger men, older women, et cetera. It really is all good.
All good.
It's all good as long as it doesn't cause, you know, I mean, obviously, as long as it's not harming another person. I think we have to realize that biologically and neurobiologically, we are, each of us is at a different stage of life and in a different internal maturation cycle. So it's really within the range of normal that sometimes you get someone who's 15-year gap in their maturity or in their needs or in what they're looking for. And but, you know, obviously if a man of 50 is getting rid of his spouse to get a younger spouse, that's what I mean. That's when I'd get involved and say, okay, watch out. But if it's all mutual, it probably is all within the range of normal.
Dr. Gurian, you say we men and women, we resolve conflict differently. How so?
Yeah, we do tend to do conflict differently. There are a number of differences. One is that males tend more toward fight or flight, and females tend more toward tend and befriend. And I'll just explain that real quick. The reason is our biochemical base. Males are testosterone dominant, and that's a fight or flight chemical. And when we get under stress, that chemical shoots up in our bloodstream and brain. So we get into a more fight or flight. So we tend to get louder or push against, or we tend to withdraw, especially if our spouse can talk a lot and remembers a lot of emotional stuff. You know, within a few minutes, we'll withdraw because we can't keep up. So fight or flight. Women are dominated by other hormones. One is oxytocin. That's a tend and befriend chemical. So when women get under stress, that bonding chemical goes up. So males go to fight or flight mode quite often, and females go to tend and befriend. Males tend to try to dominate or withdraw based on their personality, and females will tend to try to come closer. They'll tend to try to become more intimate, say more words, ask what people are feeling more. And that's a primal difference between males and females. It's robust worldwide. So I'm often coaching couples to work through that and not be surprised by that. And an example is a couple where when they get in a conflict, he just shuts down and has to withdraw because he can't verbalize. And his wife is chasing him, really chasing him through the house, saying, stop, talk to me, don't leave. And I have to get them to develop a different way of being because she's going to constantly feel rejected if she doesn't realize that his brain just shuts down. He can't get at what she wants at that moment. They have to pause, wait 10 minutes, and come back. and vice versa. I mean, you know, there's a lot of aspects to this. So that's one way in which we do conflict very differently.
You say that men and women have biochemical cycles that matter not only when we're young, but also as we get older.
Oh, yeah, and especially in the 50 to 65, in that first stage of age, the transformation stage, this biochemistry really matters. And I have helped so many marriages by helping people to see that stuff they thought was psychological, in other words, that they were somehow flawed or their partner was flawed or their marriage was flawed, that, you know, a lot of the mood stuff has to do with their biochemistry and medications they're taking around the biochemistry, even foods they're eating around their biochemistry that they're allergic to, et cetera. Far more, and I talk about this in the book, far more of what we're experiencing has to do with our biochemistry than we realize, especially 50 to 65.
As far as enjoyment of life, do we enjoy life more as we get older or do we not?
Well, that's, you know, I talk in the book about this new spirit of aging, about realistic optimism and all the science around positive thoughts and positive aging. So there's a lot of science that does show that the more we can move toward optimism and toward positive thoughts, toward purpose and meaning, you know, which bring a lot of positivity, and toward joy. I mean, it's a really good word. I have a section in there about do what gives you joy. The more we do that, the more we accomplish two things. We live longer, which is in itself an accomplishment, and two, we stave off mental illness. And this is really interesting. The more positive we are, the less likely, so the more positive we are between 50 and 60, let's say, the more we're de-stressing and the more we're finding joy and, you know, living with purpose, the more likely at 70 that we won't be struggling with mental illnesses. And that's really deep for people because we think of it as physical, but some of the longevity is the quality of life around mental illness. And so it's crucial that we de-stress and become more positive. And I give a lot of tips on how to do that.
Mm-hmm. And as I've stated a few times, you're a marriage counselor. The studies have shown that people who are married, even if it's not a great marriage, they tend to live longer than those who are single.
Yeah, yes, definitely. There's a lot of interpretations and controversy around that. My research supports that, and with the caveat that because we're all living so long, that being married could mean a divorce during the time of transformation. I mean, there is about a 35% divorce rate in that 50 to 65 age group, and most of those are instigated by women, about 63%. So it's both. And then there can be a remarriage. You know, so it's marriage is not what it was 100-150 years ago. It around 30-40% of people may be married twice or more. So putting that into the mixer, it still does show that if you can be happily married, if you can get along and be married, you're going to tend to live longer with less mental illness. And the primary reason we think is that being married in a joyful way, obviously a way that serves you, build cells up. You know, there's epigenesis.
Okay, we got to roll, Dr. Gurian, but happy 4th to you. Great book, The Wonder of Aging. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.